Welcome to Five Good Ideas. My name is Elizabeth McIsaac, and I'm the president of Maitri, a Toronto-based human rights organization. Five Good Ideas is a monthly program designed to strengthen the capacity of the nonprofit sector. For each session, we invite experts to share their practical advice on key issues faced by nonprofit organizations today. Now let's get to today's conversation. Collaboration is one of the most powerful tools available to nonprofits, and it changes everything. It extends your reach, it deepens your impact, and it helps more people get the support they need. But great collaboration doesn't start with finding the right partner. It begins with becoming one. That means your board and your senior leaders are doing the internal work first, building the right culture, the right competencies, and the systems to show up as a strong, committed collaborator. Today, we're joined by Liz Weaver, former co-CEO of the Tamarack Institute and director of Weaver Works Consulting, and Linda Mollenhauer, former CEO of Imagine Canada and chair of Ignite NPS. They are two experts well-placed to share five good ideas, five practical ideas on how to become a collaborative organization. Liz is a veteran Five Good Ideas speaker. This is her third time presenting and a longtime friend of Maitri. An experienced practitioner in collaborative governance and collective leadership, she has designed and delivered learning for leaders across topics including collective impact, community innovation, and policy change. Linda has led a consulting practice for over 20 years, serving funders and nonprofits, and published widely on collaboration, governance, and nonprofit leadership. In their presentation today, they will share practical stories and ideas about choosing the right collaborations, showing up as a strong partner, and avoiding common pitfalls. They will draw from the Collaborative Organization, a free, accessible, web-based toolkit for board members and senior staff that they have recently developed together. It is my pleasure to welcome Liz and Linda, and so pleased to have you here.
Thanks so much, Elizabeth. It's really our pleasure to be joining you, both on behalf of Linda and myself and our colleague at Tamarack, Sylvia Chu, who also contributed to the Collaborative Organization web resource. I'm going to kick us off and just describe the why behind the resource that we engaged in developing. And really, we saw a bit of a gap. As Elizabeth has said, there was a gap. There are a ton of collaboration tools out there, but we didn't really see any tools that focused on the board of directors and the organization specifically and what to do before you step into the collaboration space. And so that's really the big background behind this resource. We also recognize that while it is focused on the board and the organization, it's also the people at the table, right? And how you might use these resources in a way to really make your collaboration experience a really successful experience. There are five ideas that we're going to talk about during the course today, and we're going to bounce back and forth between Linda and myself. Linda's going to kick us off with really talking about your collaboration culture as an organization. I'm going to focus on the why of collaboration and what you need to be thinking about from that perspective. Then we're going to talk about managing the opportunities of collaboration and mitigating some of the risks, how to get your shop in order, your internal shop at your organization, and then some of the technical tools like a board policy and the memorandum of understanding. So I'm going to start by kicking it off to Linda so she can tell us about collaboration culture.
Great. Thanks, Liz. Yes, our first good idea is to be intentional about your organization's culture because it has a significant impact on the success of your collaborations. And by culture, we're talking about the values, mindsets, attributes of board members and staff, which combine to create a culture, or in many organizations, many cultures. Even if it's not talked about, it is so powerful. It influences decisions about where collaboration sits as a strategic option. It influences choices such as who you feel comfortable with partnering with, and it influences how your organization is seen in your community. If you don't actively reflect on culture, then you may be driven by the wrong things, like pressure from funders or respected community leaders, old habits and unwritten rules, norms, sometimes by the strongest personality in the room. Our research found there were three values, mindsets, and leadership attributes that had a really strong correlation to an organization's success with collaborations. I want to take a few minutes to illustrate what this culture looks like in practice. If you go to our website, you're going to find all kinds of more details and helpful tools. So as you listen, maybe reflect on your own organizational and governance culture, and maybe even your partnering organization's cultures. Okay, the first is a culture that is laser focused on the organization's purpose. By purpose, we're talking about vision, mission, outcomes. So purpose drives every decision and choice. Let's say there's an organization, and Liz, you'll agree, we've seen a few of these, with a very vocal accountant and lawyer on the board. They're fixated on finances, they're nervous about risk, and they talk a lot about the organization's survival. The staff keep having to demonstrate what collaboration delivers to the bottom line. This is an inward-focused culture. A purpose-driven culture is one of abundance. It sees other organizations as potential partners, not competitors. It appreciates that it can't significantly advance its mission alone. Assets are seen as tools to advance purpose, not just something to be protected. And advancing the purpose is the North Star when deciding whether a collaboration is the right fit. The second is a culture that's comfortable with agility, adaptiveness, and innovation. An organization that isn't these things is more top-down. There might be cumbersome processes, rigid structures, programs, siloed. This is a tough collaborative partner. In an organization that's adaptive, innovative, and agile, the board and staff are comfortable with messiness because collaborations are often very messy with inherent risks. They know how to give up power and share decision-making. They can pivot with opportunities as they emerge, and they are empowered to make collective decisions with their partners right at the table, not continuously having to check back with the boss. The bottom line is that if your organization isn't collaborative on the inside, it's less likely that it's going to be a good collaborative partner. The last characteristic of an enabling culture is a deep commitment to authentic relationships. What would this look like? Well, equity and inclusiveness are embedded into the fabric of the organization, and this lens is brought to the collaborative table. The organizational leaders cultivate extensive and, most importantly, diverse networks, and it's not done off the side of their desks. And they share knowledge, connection, resources, without expecting a direct or an immediate return. This kind of organization, this kind of leader is going to be a sought-after partner, and primarily because they can be trusted and can help lead a collaboration to success. All right, Liz, that was a real whirlwind of culture. I wanted to just very briefly talk about what you can do with all this. Anything to add that I missed?
I think culture is really important. And so it is a little bit of looking inward at your own culture and then thinking about how that translates in the collaborative experience as well, right? And so you gave, I think, really good examples of where it can be a real value add to collaboratives, but also where sometimes negative cultural aspects might hinder that collaboration process. And I know that we had a number of questions sent in advance. And so I was reflecting as you were speaking, Linda, to those questions about sharing power and authentic engagement, and culture really plays into both of those questions, I think.
Yes, exactly. That's a lot. What do you do with this? First, you can use our checklist to reflect on your own organization's culture and attributes of its leaders. If this is your culture already, then celebrate it. If it's not, then have a conversation about why these values, mindsets, and attributes are important to your collaboration success and what can be done to close the gap. We know shifting culture is very complicated, but here are a few ideas. You can incorporate them into your organization's value statement. You can incorporate them into the board and staff leadership recruitment matrix to be sure as you go forward, you're bringing in the right kind of values and mindsets and attributes. And you can start shifting a few existing practices and processes and then let culture catch up. And last, use this knowledge to better understand and empathize with your partners around the table as you think about what kind of culture they're coming from. If there's a safe space, then name it and have a conversation about the implications for your collaborations. So that's our first good idea. I'm not going to hand it over to Liz to talk about our second fabulous idea.
Yeah, the second idea is really, it builds on the idea of the culture and really understanding and valuing your organization's culture and really thinking about what is the why behind a collaboration for your organization. So this is a conversation that should happen both at the senior leadership level, but also at the board level. And so really thinking about why would our organization move forward or join a collaborative table? What's the kind of purpose behind this? And what are the benefits to the organization in terms of one being involved in one collaboration versus another collaboration? And one of the things that we realized when we were developing this resource is that if you look at what funders are saying, if you look at what governments are saying, other nonprofits, collaboration is a strategic imperative, right? And it actually should be something that leads to better outcomes, better achievements for your organization. And if you're a good collaborative partner and sitting at the right collaborative tables, it can also be a pathway towards sustainability because people, whether they're funders, whether they're government partners, whether they're the other partners in the room that you're around this collaboration table with, will value you, will value your organization's contributions. Linda and I were talking about asking the why as a generative conversation. So not jumping to the answer right away, but really asking a few questions about why would we as an organization be engaged in collaboration? What is important to our organization? What is valuable to us? What do we hope to gain from this collaboration? And what are some of the barriers that we might face in saying yes to one collaboration versus another collaboration? So it's a really, the why question is a really important starting point around a collaboration. We know that lots of you on the call are already sitting at collaborative tables and you might think, oh, okay, so we probably should have had that question, should have had that conversation a while ago. Well, it's never wrong to have this conversation, right? Because there might be collaborations that you're currently engaged in that you feel like, oh, maybe that alignment isn't there. Maybe it doesn't quite fit the culture of our organization. Maybe it's not part of our strategic imperative. And so having this conversation about your why can be really helpful in clarifying what you say yes to, what you say no to, and then also what collaborations you might withdraw from or other ones that you join. And in the resource, we have a great tool around exiting collaborations that don't necessarily fit your why. And so, you know, that's available for you as a kind of a thought piece and a reflection piece. When you've landed on your why, then it's really interesting to think about, okay, so we're strongly committed to this why. How are we going to live this out? And how are we going to direct our staff team to live this out? And what should our staff team be looking for? Those people that are sitting around the collaborative tables, both looking for, but also what can they contribute to this collaboration? And so the why is a both and approach. Linda, I'm going to share a story that really illustrates this why from one of my experiences. And the story is prior to joining Tamarack, I was the director of the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction. And one of our co-conveners was a community foundation in the city of Hamilton. Someone asked the CEO of the community foundation, why are you sitting at this table? Why is the community foundation sitting at the round table? And she very thoughtfully had a good conversation with her board. Her board was on board with them sitting at the table. She was very thoughtful in her approach. She shared that story with the other members of the collaborative round table. And it was a really good illustration of how the board had been thoughtful, the CEO was thoughtful, and then their commitment to that work was stronger as a result. And so, you know, going through a good conversation around the why, I think, is critical to be a good collaborative partner.
Yeah, and I would just say to your point about even if you're well on your way into collaborations, why have the why conversation? My experience is when I've gone around a table facilitating a conversation and asked the question, what do we mean by collaboration? And even why it's important to us. It's you often, every single person around the room has a different answer to it. So, very.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that provides a great opportunity for the collaboration for the folks around the collaborative table, because when you know each person's why, the collaboration can work much better together, right? Because they can try to link in and achieve the shared and collective whys as they move the collaboration forward.
Yes, exactly. And very linked to culture. You're going to see that everything we talk about is not linear. It's a big circle, integrated circle. Okay. Our third good idea is to proactively manage the opportunities and risks of collaboration. We know that more complex collaborations can bring great benefit to the organization, but also some risks. They might be financial, capacity, reputational, complicated accountabilities. You can't avoid these, but you can mitigate them. It's also important to remember that there's risk in not collaborating. And as Liz pointed out, sustainability, participate, being able to advance your mission and so on. And so there's risk even in not collaborating. We wanted to focus on two ways to manage opportunities and risks. One is to do a formal assessment when there's a potential collaboration opportunity or when determining whether you'll continue in a collaboration. And you're in luck because we have several fabulous assessment checklists in the collaborative organization resource. The second is to have a really good memorandum of understanding, an MOU, with your partners, which is continuously referenced, kept current, and matches the complexity of your collaboration. It'll include things like a description of the collaboration's purpose and goals, the parameters like who's participating and timelines, and most important, probably, is laying out responsibilities and capacity commitments for all the partners. And again, our resource has a checklist for an MOU. There are really four ways a thorough assessment and an MOU creates more successful collaborations. First, they fulfill the board and leadership's oversight responsibilities, which is particularly helpful for an organization that's more risk averse. They take away some of the surprises, even though there will be surprises that slip in. This is important because navigating a collaboration requires real patience and resilience. Three, they enable you and your partners to anticipate problems and address them before they get too entrenched. For example, you'll have thought about what your organization's committing to and taking the time to ensure you can deliver on it. And last, doing a thorough and honest assessment helps you ensure the strategic alignment. And if there isn't, then you can step away with a solid rationale that you can clearly communicate to others. This is going to help you with your FOMO issues, fear of missing out, and means you won't be in a collaboration simply because somebody important asked you to join it. So that's our third good idea. And now I'm going to pass it back to a very linked topic, which is around your own capacity.
Before we go on to the get your shop in order, which is the fourth good idea, I just wanted to say that with the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, I like to think about them as living documents, right? Because as you said, Linda, collaboration shift and change over time. You're going to have new partners, some partners will leave. So we recognize that there were some collaborations that were very early stage, some that were a middle scope, they might be shared programs and services, and some collaborations that were tackling a big complex issue like poverty or homelessness. And so if you think about it, you want to have the right kind of MOU for the type of collaboration that you're engaged in. And you might, if it's a very simple collaboration, you might have a very lightweight MOU. Yeah. Whereas in a more complex collaboration where there's resources and funding to be allocated and that kind of thing, there might be more agreements that need to be included in that type of a document. So, you know, find the form that fits your collaboration. Don't put in too much stuff that will be difficult to manage if it's a very lightweight kind of collaboration.
And the same with the assessment. We have various assessments for simpler collaborations, more risky collaborations. The simpler ones, your board does not need to be involved in. If they have a much higher risk or impact on the organization, maybe the board needs to see more of that. So different assessments depending on what stage it's at or what kind.
Yeah. And that ties really nicely into the fourth big idea, which is to get your own shop in order. And this is really thinking from an organizational perspective, what do you both need and what can you contribute to the collaboration, right? So how are you going to allocate the human resources that you have, the financial resources, other resources that the collaboration might need to be successful? So it's really thinking about what are the contributions that you can make as an organization to fulfill the commitments that you have when you join the collaborative table. Another one is really to think about how decision-making will happen. And so it's not only decision-making at the collaborative table, but it's decision-making within the organization. So when do you bring the decisions back up to the board because more resources have been called for? For example, within the collaborations, getting your shop in order is also about some of those strategies around mitigating risk. What kind of communications will you be having within your organization about the collaboration experience and what you're learning, how the organization is contributing, what recognition the organization might be getting, and how you're communicating upward and downward within your organization, particularly? And then really thinking about some of the challenges that you might be facing in terms of supporting, or the opportunities in terms of supporting staff and volunteers at the collaborative table. When you don't do this in advance, sometimes what we've seen is that there's an assumption by other organizations that because you're XYZ organization, you're going to be collaborating and you're going to be contributing these things. And that may or may not be something that you're able to do as an organization. I remember a time when I was the CEO of the YWCA and everybody around the collaborative table thought we could give them free meeting space because we had lots of facilities and meeting rooms. But really, we use those meeting rooms to generate revenue for the organization. And so there was a little bit of a mismatch. And so we had to come to agreement about partially giving free meeting space and then charging for meeting space for other things so that that collaborative table could move forward effectively. And so I think this is a really critical one. And the more you can do this up front in terms of what you can both give and what you need to get from the collaboration, the more successful you can be as a collaborative partner. And then finally, Linda, you are going to talk about putting things in writing. And I think we've already talked a little bit about this, but maybe just share our last big idea.
Yes, and maybe just to one quick comment adding to what you said, Liz, I think the notion of what capacity you're bringing to collaborations has to be understood that it's going to be very, very different as long as it's value add to the collaboration. And so by taking the time to look internally at what assets you can bring, not just money, but people, might be technology, it may be a client base, so many other things. By taking that time to really think about the assets you're bringing to the table, really are going to help later with power dynamics. So another reason to look into your own capacity before launching into collaboration. Okay, last idea. And as Liz said, this will be brief because we've actually talked a lot about these ideas. But the last is put it in writing. Capturing the key elements in a board policy on collaboration. And again, our resource has a great checklist with some examples of this. And this board policy should describe things like the organization's commitment to collaboration, Liz's why, how opportunities and risks will be assessed, when the board needs to be involved and when they don't, they shouldn't be involved, and how collaboration will be supported internally, both very tangibly in terms of how you're going to support the staff sitting at the table, so they're not just doing this off the side of their desks, but also some of the culture pieces that we talked about, putting an enabling culture in place. So there are three benefits of doing a board policy. Number one, it signals to stakeholders, such as board members or staff sitting at the table, to community partners, to funders, the organization's commitment to collaboration. Second, it gives the board confidence that it's fulfilling its oversight responsibilities so they can keep their noses in other words, informed and engaged, but fingers out so staff can get on with the work of collaboration. And last, it helps with leadership transitions because it's all there in writing, regardless of whether some culture pieces start to shift or other things in terms of that can happen with transition. So we'll just wrap up and open up for questions. Just a reminder, five good ideas. Culture matters. Understand the why. Manage opportunities and risks by using a good assessment and an MOU. Get your organization shop in order and create a board policy. Over to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. And Linda, I'm going to quote you going forward. At some point, you referred to it as fabulous ideas. And I think you've set the bar high. That was terrific. There was so much in there. So rich. But I want to start by walking it back. What do we mean by collaboration? What is your definition? And I remember when I started working on a very complex collaboration many years ago on Immigrant Employment Council. And I actually went back to the dictionary and said, so what does collaboration mean? We keep throwing it around. What's the definition of this thing? And I think it was an Oxford dictionary. I can't remember which one it was. So there's two definitions, the sort of etymology of it. One is an artistic endeavor among several players, or two or more players. And then the other one was working with the enemy, sort of going back to the French history of collaboration. And so I thought about that, and it has always struck me that there are sometimes elements of both of those, depending on what the work is that you're doing. And as I was listening to both of you now, I felt like you were describing it, and almost like the applicability of your ideas will shift, the importance of it will shift by the level of formality and sort of on a spectrum of simple to complex. But when I think about people talking about collaboration in our sector, it sometimes is used to describe partnerships, cooperation, alliances, networks. There's a whole bunch of it. It becomes a very interchangeable term. So I want to throw it back to both of you to start us off with, how have you been defining collaboration in this work that you've been doing to really sketch out what are the core elements? How do we do this well? How do we make this perhaps a better art form?
Maybe just very briefly, and I'm going to kick it over to Liz, is to say that all those words you use, partnership, et cetera, that's all within what we have meant by collaboration. They're just really different words in our view, because it's ultimately about one or more organizations coming together with common cause to advance their work. Key thing I would want to say is when we're talking about collaboration, it does not mean amalgamations and mergers, because that becomes one legal entity, and that's often used interchangeably, and I think scares some people away from collaboration. So we're careful to say it is not those things.
In the resource, there's a little bit of a backgrounder, which actually does go into collaboration and talks about what are we seeing as trends that are impacting collaboration right now. And I agree with Linda. I think it is the kind of spectrum of things that we talk about. But the core behind it is both from an organization perspective, what do we mean by collaboration? And what are we thinking about? So are we intentional about being a shared services kind of collaboration? Are we thinking about a collective impact kind of thing? So what do we mean? What's most effective and will help us achieve our organization's purpose and mission? And I think it's also thinking about what are the benefits to us as an organization? And there are lots of benefits, and we articulate them in some of the resources. Also, as we said, what are the risks, right? Organizations often say yes to collaborations just because they've been asked, versus doing some of that thinking prior to joining a collaborative table. And so we're suggesting that if you do some of the work up front, we know resources are tight right now, but if you do some of that work up front, you're going to have a better collaborative experience, both as a partner, but also you're bringing all of that to the collaborative table. So the table is enhanced as well in this work.
And it definitely involves artistry. And what we would like to stress is it is about not seeing enemies, but seeing potential collaborative partners.
Potential allies.
Yes.
Well, it's interesting because there was one of the early questions that was sent in is, can you talk about advocacy coalitions with unlikely partners, and that's sometimes been called strange bedfellows? And that gets to a little bit of, we don't ordinarily work together, but here we are because we have a shared purpose and that intentionality. Do you want to say anything about the unique conditions when you're not ordinary partners, when you are not the usual suspects?
I think there's a little bit more that has to be done when you're not usual suspects to build relationship and understanding and do some of that. We're suggesting the organization do the work, but each of the partners should do this kind of work around their own organizations and then in a trustful way share that at the table, right? So when you know the why, when you know your own why, but when you know the whys of others and the culture of other organizations, then I think trust and relationships really grow from that space, right? And that makes for effective collaborations. When there's mistrust or distrust or huge power imbalances within a collaborative table, those collaborations, we've seen them go off track and go awry. It's really thinking through for each organization, what is their why? What is their collaboration culture? And then what can they contribute are three really important things to weave into that early work of a collaboration.
One of our five resources is an article called Collaboration Under Strain. And I think it's not that long, it's not too dense, and it answers this question absolutely beautifully, including the importance, and perhaps this is where the culture and attributes of the leadership within one organization, perhaps the more powerful one, is so important, is to be able to empathize in terms of what those other organizations, what they're trying to achieve, put value on that, and also what are the constraints, real life constraints. And I use the word empathy, and that's really important, being able to step into their shoes and see it as they see it, because at the end of the day, nobody is intending to come in to be difficult. So it's a great article and worth the read.
A lot of what both of you are saying has so much to do with really reflecting, being mindful, intentional, discerning purpose, and being attentive to that. It's a relationship, and it's all the things that make for a good relationship. It strikes me that the best collaborations require an abundance mindset. You mentioned this in the presentation, which can be tough in a resource-constrained environment or mindset. Any advice for organizations who want to collaborate but who are already feeling overwhelmed? This is one more thing. What do you say to them?
Oh, I would begin by assessing how many collaborative partnerships you're in already and what is that taking, and are there some that maybe aren't as meaningful to you as an organization or as purposeful to you as an organization. And this can be both internal collaboration, but also external collaboration, right? Because we often within organizations have multiple teams that are collaborating together as well. So I think that that's a really important thing to think about. And also consider whether the time is right for you as an organization to be at a collaborative table at this time. Because the reality is that some organizations are so resource constrained that you show up at the table, but you're not authentically showing up, and that hurts everybody else around the collaborative tables. Could you be on a mailing list about what that collaboration is doing? Could you be consulted? So you don't necessarily have to be at the collaborative table, but are there other ways to engage with that work in a way that connects you but doesn't commit you? So I think that the reality is to do that organizational assessment, look at what your reality is at this moment, and then really consider, would I be a good collaborative partner given the constraints that I'm facing, that our organization is facing right now?
And I would add to that something too. I've been in the sector many, many, many decades, and I've watched the sector really can be caught up into that scarcity mindset. They're all my competitors for resources, and almost a fear and intensity to that. And this notion of abundance, I don't think is a soft sort of would be nice to have philosophy. I think it is going to be the way to think about how you're going to survive as an organization, and really say, should we exist? Because if you put purpose first and you need to advance the mission, should we exist? Secondly, this notion of sustainability that Liz touched on, that we're going to have to collaborate with organizing, whether it's shared back office, shared programming, and so on. It means giving something up in order to gain something. But I would suggest we got to rid ourselves of scarcity mindset, and we need to embrace abundance mindset, and that it'll come right down to survival.
As this is probably a room full of change makers, and we find ourselves situated in different places in organizations, some on boards, some at a high level of leadership in the organization, and some from the middle, and trying to lead from the middle. You talked at length at the beginning about culture, and you need to have the right culture to do this and to do it well. If you're trying to move this forward and you're trying to lead from the middle, do you have suggestions around how to push that up into the organization? If the organization itself may have not a readiness or an openness or some of those other conditions that you talked about, do you have advice for leading from the middle and really creating that condition from there?
You want to go first, Linda?
I think that's a really tough thing, especially if you're in a bit of a hierarchical organization where the board sits on top. How do you push it up that way? Ideally, an organization is more agile than that. If that's the case, then having those conversations is going to be a lot easier to have. But I think starting with Everybody agrees we want our collaborations to be successful. I'm sitting at the tables and I can't be successful if I don't feel I have an organization that is supporting me in the way I need to be supported. And this is what that looks like. Grab some of the language from our stuff and use that to make your case, because I'm assuming the intent is to be successful at their collaboration, no matter where you sit in the organization.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that organizations are not static. We think they're static, but they're fluid, right? We go through these cycles of change, whether it's leadership change or priority changing or funding changing. And so there will be opportunities to seed that conversation from the middle and to say, if you are assigned to a collaboration by your CEO or executive director or your department lead, that's a place to start that conversation. What resources can I expect to support my involvement in this collaboration, or even be a bit more proactive and say, hey, these are resources that I think I could really use to represent the organization in the best way around this collaborative table. So it's always an opportunity to think about things in that abundance mindset, in that opportunity mindset, and to move that conversation forward. Because I agree that if you've been assigned something, it's a window.
And maybe our assessment tool can be helpful too for them to look at and say, these are all the things that are going to help us make sure this collaboration is the right collaboration. And again, use some of that language to communicate up in your organization.
The more we talk about this, the more it feels like relationship counseling. and we have a question. What is the best practice to mitigate a fallout, when a fallout happens, when the relationship falls apart, to protect the vision? We've all come to the table because we have a shared purpose and vision. Sometimes the relationships don't work. How do you protect the vision when that begins to fall apart?
I think from my experience being on many collaborations and having actually experienced some of that relationship fallout is to not acknowledge it. To be able to say, hey, what is happening here to us? And how do we overcome this? Or how do we close this collaboration down? Because I do think there are different strategies. What might we do to move forward? I've seen a lot of collaborations where they don't acknowledge it, where someone might disrupt the collaboration, someone might move away from the collaboration, and people think, oh, what happened there? And nobody acknowledges this. It's got quietness in the room. And I think you do have to acknowledge it, because collaboration is dynamic. As Linda said, it takes patience and it is very relational, as we've talked about. And when you don't acknowledge it, what happens is that it can seed even more disruption and more people walking away, and then the collaboration dies a slow death, right? So you show up and you had 12 people around the table. The next time there's 6 people, then there's 3 people, and then you're sitting in the room on your own. And so by not acknowledging when that first person has left, or a couple of people, or there's a tense situation around the collaborative table, you do yourself and the collaboration a disservice. And the reality is that in most communities, it's likely that you're going to see these partners at another collaborative table in the future. And if you had a very poor collaborative experience collectively, that will likely lead to mistrust in the future. And so I think it is really important to address it.
And I would add to that that I've seen lots of collaborations and they've got some partners. They have this inspiring vision, perhaps. They maybe have some funding. And it's a hurry to go slow. There's pressure to let's go, let's show results. And I think what you keep hearing from Liz and I is how important these initial conversations are about what are the shared expectations, what culture do you all come from, why are you here, what are your constraints. Have that up front and take the time, take a deep, deep breath and take the time, because it will save you down the road. By the time people are walking around from the table, perhaps you can bring them back and say, we need to go back to some of these conversations, or it's too late and some collaborations aren't meant to be. But I think it's that upfront, proactive, intentional stuff that feels soft but isn't.
It's the condition for success. I want to give you both an opportunity to say, I think I'm the funder in the room. I'm hoping there's others as well. When are funders a help? When are they a hindrance to collaboration? And do you have advice to funders on how to be a good partner, how to show up in the right way?
I think that funders can be incredibly powerful partners around a table when they see themselves as valued and contributing partners. Because if you think about what a funder brings, more than just the funding, right? They have a network, they have access to thought leaders around the idea, they have knowledge-based resources, or other organizations have these too. I like to look at the whole package with funders, and there's often an interest and a commitment. So the example I gave you about the Hamilton Roundtable for Poverty Reduction and the role of the Community Foundation and the City of Hamilton, they were both funders of this work, but they were incredibly committed to the outcomes of the work and willing to put the time into sitting around the table, and also in the case of the city, brought in municipal elected officials and other team members. And in the case of the Community Foundation, brought in their board, as did all the other partners. So they led by example in that way. So it really can be very powerful. There are also cases, though, where the funder is asking for collaboration but isn't supportive of the work of the collaboration, right? They are hopeful of the outcomes, but not necessarily the infrastructure or the timing or whatever it is in terms of the conditions of the collaboration. So a really good conversation about that, depending on the complexity of the issue, right? So if you take an issue like homelessness, it's a complex issue, multivaried, has multiple intersecting elements to it. So when you have a very complex issue, you know the journey is going to be a little bit longer. And so patience, persistence, and also focusing on what are the right outcomes at the right stages of this work, I think are really critical. And that's an important conversation to have with a funder around any kind of collaboration.
I just want to pick up on one thing that you said first, Liz, and then over to Linda. You referred to a funder can be powerful at the table. Power can also be a negative in this dynamic. And so is there a way of deflating that in some way? Because that can become a problem.
When I've worked with multi-sector collaboratives where it's individuals with lived and living experience and business and government and nonprofit, each of those sectors or each of those groups has power in a different way, right? And so it is really understanding that each group has a power that they bring to the conversation and knowledge, deep knowledge and deep resonance about their own experience. And it's the kind of leveraging of those that can be really helpful to a collaboration where there are diverse partners. So the one thing I recognized in the Hamilton Roundtable experience where we had 10 individuals with the lived experience of poverty, they brought deep knowledge of the lived experience of poverty that none of the other partners around the table had. And that was so critical to identifying which strategies would work, which strategies wouldn't work, how to move forward, that kind of thing. So, yeah, we got to kind of look at power in a way that really acknowledges that each group has power. And how can the collaborative experience benefit from the gifts and the power of each of the groups?
Thank you. And Linda, the last minute is to you.
Well, I really would just stress all the things that we've talked about. It's the same. It's culture, it's personality and attributes. If you're going to be somebody with great empathy, then you're going to have a lot more success and so on. And it's just name the power, acknowledge it, talk about it upfront. Don't be afraid of it. Even if it's perceived or real, it doesn't matter. So that would be my final comment on that.
It's a human endeavor. Organizations are full of humans. And so all the great things of humans and all the challenges of humans are right there in collaboration. Thank you.
Amen to that.
Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Linda. This has been fabulous.